Welcome back to another Tuesday night with your hosts, Star and Lisa. Aaron's out this one. Tonight we're talking about ufology. Star, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. How are you doing tonight, Lisa?
Good. 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 How's the weather up there?
Nasty.
As always.
It was 40-something degrees yesterday, and today it's just snowing and blowing, and it's nasty.
I'm not jealous. So tonight we are bringing on Bill. Now, I might have a little trouble with this, Konkluski. And he is the Michigan State Director of MUFON. I've seen him speak in Michigan at a Paracon, I guess you would call it. A wonderful speaker. He's appeared on, so many channels you can't even list them all. We've got, everything from the History Channel, Discovery, Science, Sci-Fi, National Geographic. He's written books. I noticed there was some filmography. And, speaks at conferences and everything. So kind of a little bit of everything when it comes to ufology. Bill, we want to welcome you to the show. Are you there?
Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to us about this, because we like to kind of hit on everything with U.S. Paranormal. We hit on, everything from voodoo to hoodoo to UFOs to you name it. I mean, we like to hit across the board, you know. We don't neglect or leave anybody out. Sarge, do you want to start with a question, or you want me to start first? If you had a preference.
Yeah. Bill, how did you come to be a part of, what is it, MUFON?
And what does MUFON stand for those that don't know?
Yeah, what does that stand for?
Okay, MUFON is Mutual UFO Network. It's a UFO investigative group that's been around since 1969. I've only been around on this earth since 1971, so I wasn't here for its foundation, but I have been a member since 1993. MUFON is the world's largest civilian research organization for UFOs. We're pretty much an all-volunteer army. We have right now, I don't keep hard track of the count, but somewhere probably between 3,000 to 4,000 members, I think, at last count that I heard. Our Michigan chapter's got a pretty healthy membership of about 100 members, and we've been going strong for decades now.
Now,
well,
when you mentioned those numbers, is this does every state have members, or is it just particular states?
Well, every state has members. I can be pretty confident in saying that. Different states have more stronger chapters than others.
Right.
Sometimes just a matter of luck. Sometimes, due to large population, a lot of factors can come into play. But Michigan's been blessed that the entire time that I've been aware of our chapter, that we've had some good, strong members in on our team, and a lot of them.
So, if someone were to become interested in that field, how do they become involved like you did years ago?
Well, if you go to MUFON.com, you will find a lot of information about the parent organization. And if you're looking to get involved, there's a couple different ways to do that. One, if you're really interested in investigating the UFO phenomena, you can become a field investigator through MUFON. Also, if you want to see if your state chapter has active meetings, many of the state chapters have their own websites. I would maybe even venture to guess most of them. And you can find out if they meet locally, like Michigan meets locally 5 times a year, including this upcoming Sunday as our first meeting for this year.
So I've got several questions. I had asked someone... I wanted to get kind of a question from someone other than me. And I said, if you had one question to ask this person that studies ufology, what would you ask them? What's the one question? And he said, why isn't there more evidence or proof with all the technology and the papers that there are? you know, like with nowadays, he said, compared to, you know, years ago, he said, why isn't there more evidence or proof? What would you say to that kind of question?
So the question is, with everybody having a cell phone, how come there isn't stronger evidence?
Right,
that kind of thing,
right.
Along
with,
those lines?
Yeah, all the technology and stuff, yeah. And, you know, they have those drones. They have everything nowadays. I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the drones are a good point, Ed, that are, well, I'll start off with the, I think, the heart of the question, and I'll get into the exception of drones. When somebody sees something in the sky that they can't explain, usually they're pretty much awestruck for a moment, but at the point that it takes them to realize, hey, that shouldn't be there, you know, or I'm not quite sure what that is, or hey, what the heck is that? A lot of times people think their sighting lasts maybe several seconds, when in reality it only lasts, you know, 1 to 3 seconds, and people think that they see it for longer than they really do. Now, if you were to have seen something in the sky and then decided, oh my gosh, this is worth taking a picture of or a video, and you grab your camera or your phone, and, oh, okay, say you are lucky enough that it's actually on you and not just nearby, and you have to scramble for for it, which takes a few precious seconds, then, you know, you probably have to lock it, open up the camera function, and or whatever, and just, or some of the ones that have those shortcuts where you can even take a picture, sometimes that is a delay of a couple few seconds there. You have to focus
right
on what it is you want, and if it's far away, as I mean, unless the thing is basically across the street from you, you know, a close sighting, if you're taking a picture of something that's up at cloud level or whatever, you're going to take a picture of a speck, you know, or at night, possibly
right,
a light. Maybe the light zigzags a little bit. And, you know, and people will then wonder, hey, is the light zigzagging, or can the person just not hold their camera straight, that sort of a thing. So just a little tip, when you're taking a picture of something, if you can ever get something else in the picture, like a tree or part of a building or something like that, just to have some sort of sense of size, of, you know, that the fact that, of distance, you know, just something to throw in the especially in the case of video, it's really helpful too.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
So first of all, it takes you, the brain, a while to process. You know, I can't tell you how many times somebody said, oh my gosh, you know, I should have taken a picture right away, but I just couldn't take my eyes off of it. And then followed by, you know, I went to grab something, but by that time it was too late. Or I did look, I took this picture of it, but when I saw it, it was a lot more impressive than it is through my camera. Or what we also get quite a bit of is, for some reason, my camera didn't work. Something electronically in the air, or who knows what's going on, but possibly intentional from the object itself, which, you know, it seems hard to believe, but a lot of times we've had investigators, their equipment fail in certain situations at certain sites where they were investigating UFOs. So some kind of bad stuff happens to electronics oftentimes,
right,
too.
Right, kind of interference.
Mm-hmm. And
that kind of that kind of parallels like paranormal investigating, where you get the interference and stuff. So, and yeah, wow. To think that they could interfere and, like, prevent filming or prevent, you know, stop some of that.
I do have high hopes in drones, though. I haven't seen anything drone related yet. John Cassidy of Bumps in the Night here in Michigan has a great drone that he's very deft at flying, and so maybe one day, fingers crossed, he'll catch something and I'll catch wind of it. But I'm excited about the technology. The funny thing about drones is actually what I get is people reporting drones as UFOs. So
yeah,
that's my experience with drones. People see it and they don't know what it is, and they give their UFO group local UFO group a call to see, you know, what it is.
Star, did you have anything?
Well, I've got some questions that I kind of had. I did some research and some things on different kinds of UFOs and people that had seen the UFOs, and it also experienced crash sites, abduction or whatever. And so my questions kind of lean that way. And the most, I think, probably one of the most famous places that we know about is Area 51. And I was just kind of, you know, wondering, what are your thoughts on Area 51? Have you had any interaction with the military there or with the reports, anything about any of that?
And maybe we can toss in Aurora Cemetery as well. Are you familiar with Aurora Cemetery in Texas at all, or no?
I've heard of it. I'm not. I probably wouldn't have anything.
Okay, it's not as popular as Area 51. But I was gonna say, if you know of it as well, that'd be a good question to tie in, because I'd be curious if your opinion on that one as well. But we can stick to Area 51.
Yeah, Area 51 certainly is fascinating, and I would take it as far as to say romantic, you know, a little bit of Americana about this UFO legend of the base. Now, I have, you know, heard from a great many people who do the type of research that say that, you know, that there's stuff there that's pretty exotic. Possibly reverse engineered craft from elsewhere, and you know, certainly test flights of things that are pretty advanced on our part as well. So, you know, I don't think there's any reasonable doubt that, you know, the place has earned its legend. And one of the most interesting stories that I had heard was a guy that my dad used to work with. I heard it through my father, after he no longer worked with the guy and somehow couldn't get in touch with him. He said, yeah, this coworker of mine, he said when he was in the military, he saw them working on discs there, and that they were trying to reverse engineer them. And, you know, I'm desperately trying to get a hold of, I was this gentleman, but that was about 20 years ago. I never got a hold of him. And my personal experience with Area 51, and this is only light humor anecdote type of a thing, but my wife and a couple friends of ours drove out there in 99, I think it was, and when we started to approach the base, the rental car that we were in, we had the radio off, but somehow the radio turned on by itself, as did the windshield wipers, and the radio started changing stations, and our windshield wipers started going on the vehicle. With, you know, and we didn't do a darn thing to either of them, and we reached a certain point, and then they stopped. We didn't get close enough to be shooed away or closely observed or anything like that. But it was a curious whole thing that happened. For my own part, since I'm part of a group that investigates bases locally as my primary thing that I do, I have to say my plate is so full with UFO sightings all the time. I had about 200 last year, which is actually low end, par for the course. We always have 200 to 300 at least sightings a year generally. And so when you have that many local sightings, your hands are tied, you know, your plate is full with the local sightings. And so when people say, you know, do you think the government's hiding anything? Do you think the military's hiding anything? Yeah, of course. You know, if they weren't hiding something, you know, they hide stuff about the budget, you know. So if they weren't hiding stuff about UFOs, it would be probably the only thing they weren't hiding them something about. So clearly something that they know is being withheld from the public. But I, for my part, since we have such a busy traffic here in the, you know, in my local area, I don't have to be concerned about what the, you know, the government or the military may know or may not know. I don't need that sort of validation to have my, you know, proof that this phenomena is very real, very much ongoing, because, you know, like I said, it's just, I don't need to go very far to have that validation just locally.
Right.
So I was going to ask about your personal experiences and what made you believe 110% yes, this is something. Have you had something happen or seen things? How many sightings have you personally had?
Yeah, And for me, a lot of times the type of discussions I'm in is always sort of regarding somebody else who had seen a craft at some sort of distance. But admittedly, I got into the business because of very close and personal stuff that had happened to me, starting at a very young age and continuing through my whole life. In fact, my very first memory in life at age 2 is a little gray guy coming up to my crib. And this wasn't a memory that came back to me later, felt hazy, felt dreamlike or anything. No, this little gray guy came into my room. And then I went to have experiences with little gray guys at age 4, 7, 9, 10, well into my teen years, several times in my teen years, and then early 20s had some a lot of experiences too. And that's the time where I found MUFON in back in 93, where the director at the time, the state director, Shirley Coyne, she also was the head of MUFON International's abduction investigation. And so I went through several discussions with her, some regressions, a lot of ruminating on what was going on with me, and I stayed on with MUFON, and in 2004 became the state director and have been on board ever since, excuse the pun. But for my experiences, they happened, I'll break it down a little bit further in this regard. When I was a little kid, they came to me sort of playfully, friendly, kind of like playmates. In my teen years, I was taken several times against my will, and had a lot of unfortunate experiences there. And then in my 20s, I had a very much different relationship with them, where they seemed to be very interested in the direction my life was going. My career path, my social path, things like that, they somehow took a very keen interest in. And things have sort of mellowed to a great degree from that point. I still have a lot of unusual things happen to me. However, the straightforward abduction material that filled my teen years, it's a lot different experience than then, where I would every night be up quite late with a sort of a homemade obstacle course in my room to prevent anything from coming in or anything from happening to me. And of course, that didn't work at all. They still found a way to get to me.
And this was in your teen years.
The teen years were the worst. Yeah, they were the most harrowing. I had the most experiences then, the most negative experiences, at least negative on my part. Yeah, I really don't think they had intended any terror or great discomfort or anything like that. I think they just didn't really care much either way. I think they understood that I would get by and survive whatever they were doing to me. And so they just kept doing it with I felt a great in a great part that way about any time I've been to a doctor, been to a hospital too. They care to a certain point, but then it's, they have their job to do. They have their business. They have to process you. They have to do whatever they need to do with you. They need to get you out of the hospital, that sort of a thing. So just imagine that amped up several times.
Right. So I have a question. You remember everything that happened to you when you were taken and abducted and when they did these tests and stuff on you?
I remember quite a bit. It's an interesting point to say, do I remember everything? I remember so much that I think there's a great deal that I still don't recall. They do their best to erase your memory, to do things to you when you're not necessarily fully conscious. It's not to say that I haven't had experiences far away from home and with other witnesses there. But when they can, they'll come in the middle of the night while you're asleep and try to blend whatever happened to you into your night cycle, and so that you don't remember quite a bit of it. But The one experience that really I think gives a good impression of what can happen. It goes back to age 7, and I call on this one a lot because I have a scar from it, and I remember, I know how I got the scar, and it was from being on board. They had brought me on and sat me in a chair inside a craft and told me if I was really good, I would get to see the color blue. Which is weird. As a 7-year-old, you think, "Oh, where's my sticker? Where's my sucker?" You know, but you know, I get to see the color blue. What kind of reward is that? So the entity that had me, I say, sort of strapped to the chair, but I was magnetically attached to the chair in some way that I'm not really certain how it was working. But the being got down into my face, and then I felt a sharp pain on my right arm. I looked over at it. I didn't see what made the incision, but I could see it healing in front of my eyes. And I thought obviously that was very strange. I looked back at the creature and its eyes. It was a gray being about 5 feet tall, had deep black eyes. But when I turned back at it to look at it after it had sliced my arm, its eyes suddenly turned to a bright backlit blue. And
oh, wow.
It was, and I don't know how, you know, the biology and how that can work, but it was mesmerizing, tranquilizing, and it was just this pure bliss it was able to put into me through the power of its eyes. And the next day, I'm out in the backyard playing in the tree that we had in my backyard with a friend of mine from across the street. And this mist rolled into the backyard. And when my friend and I saw it, I thought, oh, my gosh, is it a fire? Is it, you know, some barbecue? Or what's going on? Why is this smoke coming into the backyard? But when it hit me, it was a very cool mist, very much like a fog machine. And inside the mist was a little gray guy. And he telepathically asked if I was okay. And I said, yeah, I'm fine. And I knew that it was sort of a follow-up to the last night's events. And then it seemed satisfied, and then it walked away in the middle of this cloud into the next door neighbor's backyard, and then it just kept going and then disappeared from there. The friend across the street, he remembers the mist still to this day, and you know, now we're much older, but he never saw the little guy inside the mist, just remembered how weird it was. This cloud came just strolling through my backyard while we were back there playing.
So I have kind of a double question that's related to that. And one was going to be, do you believe in the implants, which obviously you do because you've had that experience. But the second was, you hit on the stats as far as sightings, but what about the stats as far as abductions and implants? Is that just as high? And what do you get with that?
First, let me preface it by saying, although something cut my arm, I'm not sure if it inserted anything or took something out
okay.
or just cut my arm to take a skin sample. I haven't had any
gotcha.
Necessarily distinct impression that there's been anything inside me for any sort of length of time, though I know several people personally that have said that, and I've seen x-rays, and I've seen this one friend of mine show, you know, under the surface of his skin, something was clearly under there. I don't know what it was. But it's really tough to get these things out. And the one, you know, Dr. Lear, who was a big assistant to MUFON for several years, he's no longer with us, so meaning he's passed away. And it doesn't seem like anybody's really stepped up. Surgery is expensive. And a lot of times when you actually go after these things under the skin, from what I understand, they're elusive. They'll just either disappear before the surgery, or when you go after them, they'll actually elude the efforts to try to get them out. Claims of having stuff under the skin, I would say of all the abductees that reach out to move on, just using that scope, those who reach out to MUFON, I would say it could be maybe as high as maybe 1 in 4, which I still think is quite a bit. And I have to say, when people reach out to a UFO organization about their abduction event, it's usually that they're looking for something specific, and a lot of times that's the ability to have regression. They are looking to report something that's physically happened to them, is the other big thing. A lot of times, if somebody's had an abduction event and really they just want to have some sort of person to get it off their chest on, they don't tend to report their UFOs through the straightforward MUFON channels, because when you go to the MUFON website, there's a lot of checkboxes, and the as far as we've gotten, the report form is still, for the most part, based upon, you know, I saw an object at this height, it was this color at this time, et cetera, et cetera. And when somebody has an abduction event, you know, try, you know, even that short story I told about when I was age 7, it's really tough to record that onto a checkbox form, style form.
Right.
And sure, if you have open-ended narrative spaces where you can put your information, you know, if I were to have typed out, you know, what had happened to me at some length, you know, there I go. I've started writing a book, because it's a little bit of a lengthy account. And, yeah, so eventually, of course, that's what I did end up doing about my first 20 years. I recorded all the information as best I could, as best I remembered it, with the help of my regression sessions that I'd had later on, and said, you know, here's an annal of what it's like to grow up with this type of experience. And so I put it out as my book is, it's on Amazon and other places. It's called Experiencer, Raised in Two Worlds. I had seen a lot of material out there about, particularly from the likes of, say, like a Bud Hopkins or John Mack, who said, you know, talking about dealing with children who'd had these types of experiences. But for me, I wanted to put something out about, hey, this is what it's like to actually be that child, and from that child's perspective, growing up, you know, in these two worlds, one, you know, the normal day-to-day life, and the other, this really far out stuff that everybody around the world, you know, denies even exists, except it's part of your daily experience.
Well, I think we're going to take a quick short 3-minute break from there and come back in just a minute. We're going to play some Brandon Jeffries, and it's Well Enough Alone. And then we're going to come back with some more. I've got some more questions for you, and I'm sure Star does as well. So, yeah. So, you guys, stay tuned. We'll be right back. right. Welcome back. If you're just now joining us, we have Michigan State Director of MUFON, Bill Konkoleski, joining us talking about UFOs and everything associated with them, abductions and all. Did you want to start off a question?
Yeah, I've done some research that I told you about. I've always been interested in UFOs and aliens, and I believe in them. I've always said, you know, because I am a Christian, I believe that God created everything. And so I've always said that who are we as people to be so arrogant to say that there is not someone, something else way out there in the universe or universes, as we now know, who are we to say that they can't come here and visit with us or that they're not real or whatever? Anyway, getting back to what I was going to say and to ask is, in my research, I noticed that there were several famous people. President Jimmy Carter, he saw a UFO, and there were several people with him that saw that UFO. Also, there were astronauts Edgar Mitchell and Gordon Cooper. Gordon Cooper, as a matter of fact, chased a UFO, or he says he did, across Europe in 1951 in his Air Force F-86 fighter jet. So, you know, these things just amaze me. Are you familiar with Nick Pope, Bill?
Sure. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I met him briefly at the he'd been a regular at MUFON symposiums for a while. I haven't been to a recent one, but I'm well familiar with who he is.
Okay. For those of you that are not familiar with Nick Pope, he is the British Minister of Defense, an investigator in charge of UFO sightings from 1991 to 1994. Now, in an interview with Buck Wolf on ABC News, Pope said this. He said that he's interviewed thousands of people who claim to have had paranormal experiences. And he says, I cannot say that I have proof that these people really saw what they claim to have seen, but I believe a lot of them were telling the truth. Many of them are credible. Some of them have bizarre scars on their body that no doctor can explain. So that kind of goes along with what you were talking about for yourself. You have a scar on your arm from when you were 7 years old. A question about that is, have you personally ever gone and had it x-rayed or anything to see if there's anything in there?
No, I have not. I suppose intuitively, I'd never really suspected that there was anything there. A lot of times with experiencers, there's that bit of intuition that goes along with it, where they feel like, you know, something. You wake up with a bloody nose, and you don't just think, "Oh my gosh, oh, I got a bloody nose." You think, you know, I have a distinct impression that something was stuck up there, or in the ear, or behind the ear, or behind the eye of all places, or somewhere, you know, or else on the body. But I never really thought to have it. It just looks like a, you know, an incision. So yeah, it never really. Yeah, and at the time that I had it, it would have been probably until age 18 where I would have been able to independently request it, because although my family, I'm not the only one in my family who's had strange things happen to them. I don't think that the family would have felt footing the bill for an X-ray for, you know, whatever.
That was going to be one of my questions, is how your friends and coworkers and family and everything, are they accepting? Do they criticize you? You know, how are they with this?
I've been blessed of everybody being completely supportive. And so I can't think of a time in recent memory that I've ever felt awkward around my friends, family members, anything like that. And partly because it just so happens that a lot of the people that I hang around have had weird things happen to them as well. I work at a community college, and I've been blessed to actually do UFO presentations at the college where I work. So, you know, talk about that for acceptance. I will say that some of the high strangeness stuff I don't freely share. You know, I understand that It's a lot to sort of dump on somebody who's not internally curious about such things. So for a lot of people, they think, oh, yeah, Bill's got this normal side, and then his weird side is he investigates UFOs. And to me, I'm like, well, I investigate UFOs, and my weird side is I've been on some. A lot of people don't take the conversation that far. You know, I'm pretty open about what's happened to me. And, I mean, it's part of my life story. A friend of mine, Sandy Nichols, also an experiencer, asked me a bunch of years ago, he's like, do you ever wish that this had never happened to you, any of these abductions, any of this? And I had to, it hit me. I had to respond, you know, quite frankly, I'm like, I don't know if I would identify myself. I don't know if I'd recognize who I'd be without this in my life, because my very first memory is of this type of experience, and all through my life, it's been there. I can't imagine what it would be like without this type of thing. And I feel really bad for those who have their first experience or their first remembered experience much later in life. Because, I mean, just coming from a perspective of, I can understand why some people balk at the UFO phenomena if they've got their own busy life and they've grown up within some sort of system where UFOs don't quite neatly fit. Because if I'm even telling somebody about UFO sightings, maybe not even sightings that I've had, but if I tell them, oh, here are some interesting recent Michigan sightings, and what they have to do is, first of all, if they choose to believe it, they then have to say, well, what does this mean for my religion? What does this mean for my outlook on life? What does this mean for the future of our planet? You know, all these questions, it's a heavy burden. And so somebody could listen with interest and then maybe quarantine it or shut it out and go upon, you know, with the rest of their life, something I like to call having a luxury of disbelief. But when you have a highly dramatic sighting or close encounter experience at a later part in life where you've already sort of developed who you are and you know who you are, and then something just goes and snaps at, then that's really rough. For me, I had the ability to have my whole life to learn to cope with it, and you know, a lot of people don't have that.
You know, just thinking about it, do you think that and they probably were part of it, but do you think that they were taking you so often, even from a young age, to watch you as you grew up and to just kind of scientifically, watch how your body developed through the years?
Yeah, I do feel that that's a big part of it. I don't necessarily think they had anything to do with my conception, but once I made my way onto the scene, suddenly I was of high interest, and high interest through my whole life. And one of the things is not just physically were they curious in terms of my growth, but also the way that I developed psychologically, socially, spiritually, how I was able to interact with them at different steps through my life. And one of the stranger things is that a lot of my experiences were not even physical. They would come to me and pull me out of body, and I would have experiences outside of my physical self with these things. And I know that's for those who are listening who think it's a great jump to sort of follow experiences that are physical, try, you know, telling people that some of these experiences don't necessarily happen physically. And, you know, I like to sort of back it up for someone who might balk at that, say, why the heck would they do that? I think it makes perfect sense. For one thing, if these things are technologically far more advanced than we are, which is an easy assumption, I believe they've gotten to a point where they can just sort of pop in and out of their physical form. They have a control of their consciousness, which allows them to enter a physical state or leave it. And a lot of the grays that people are seeing, including ones that I have seen, I think are, you could almost say that they're puppets of this sort of consciousness that's temporarily popped in them so that they could work within a physical state. And the logistical benefit of having that sort of technology is, you know, I would say goes without saying. Say they're at some distant spot out in space and they want to come to Earth and interact with somebody, and it's not for physical reasons. They don't need to do anything, any sort of physical exam. They just want to communicate with somebody or have some sort of experience with somebody that's not physical. Well, then from somewhere out in deep space, they can probably project themselves here. There's no worry about having to hide the UFO or worry about how to sneak in or sneak out of somebody's house without waking the rest of the people in the house or alerting the neighbors or the dog or what have you. They just go, in some sort of out-of-body form, come in, pop that person out of body, go about their business on some other sort of dimensional plane, and then, you know, pop that person back in their body, and then there's absolutely no evidence that anything had happened. And I have certainly had physical encounters, and not all of them was I just by myself. So there's definitely a physical element to it, but in many of the experiences that I've had too, when they didn't need to pull me physically, it was, you know, they would pull me out of body.
I have a question. How do you, with all these sightings and reports and stuff that comes in that you get, how do you debunk them, or what's the process in saying, yeah, this is legit or this is not legit? Do you have some kind of protocol or process you go through?
That's an excellent question. And that I have had people tell me some highly extraordinary things, and I am able to readily take them at their word. And other people come up with some fairly relatively mundane sightings, and I don't believe them. A lot of it comes with experience. The more you talk to people, the more you get a sense. There's, you know, sort of a catalog of red flags, and I don't mean that it actually exists. It's just that when...
let me ask you this. So, like, in paranormal investigating, we ask them... even about their psych meds, we will get very personal. We go through their home, you know, we'll ask doctors' names, psychiatrists, what meds are you on? Do you go to that extent as well with your process?
I don't know any investigator that takes it to that level. So, you know, certainly as an all-volunteer army, and unless anybody in the group is got some sort of training that goes along with that, we don't get that invasive. So is it possible that, we're missing some of the, things that disqualify certain sightings? It's possible. Now, see, when people, and I can approach it this way, when people report stuff to us, we can identify, I'd say, about 80% of what people report to us, be it Chinese lanterns, sky lanterns, you know, or drones, or they see a planet or star they somehow think is acting unusual, or they misidentify fairly easily to identify aircraft, that sort of a thing. And it comes down then to the veracity of that last group of things that we can't fully explain. And for a straightforward sighting, it's not as problematic as, say, possibly an abduction or experiencer type scenario, where it may be helpful to dig into that level. But say, for example, somebody comes to us with an experience. They were sitting on their back porch. They saw a blue ball of light fly into the back over their backyard. It dropped, then shot straight up, and then whizzed away at some really tremendous speed. And they stick to their story. They seem to that's the way I want to put this. They
be consistent.
Yeah, the consistency is a big thing. I was trying to add on to that another thing that I think is very helpful, and I'll put it out there this way. If somebody comes to you, and I'll exaggerate to make a point, and that's what they saw, and the way they give you that report, if I was back there and then I suddenly had a feeling I was being watched, and I saw this blue ball. And I had a, you know, I had a sense that it was somehow connected to the Pleiades, and you know, I and it came down, and I knew that the reason that it descended was to show me a sign, and then it zipped off, and you know, I don't know, and I certainly had experiences where I know that what's happened has gone out of its way to sort of leave an impression on me personally. However, those things, when somebody, you know, basically what's happened is they saw a blue ball of light do some crazy maneuvers. If they start to embellish what they saw with their own personal narrative, that's when those other factors, I suppose, come into question. Was this truly a telepathic thing that they received possibly from this light? Or are they confabulating to make a more interesting story? Or is, hey, maybe we should even doubt some of the basic details of what they saw? That sort of a thing. But the great majority of sightings are people who just say, in a very sort of straightforward, no-frills sense, I saw this light, I saw this object, I had a natural reaction to it, fear, you know, I don't want anybody to know about it. I have no idea what it is. Maybe you guys can tell me what it is. You know, but if they approached you as if you are the authority, that's generally a good sign. If they approach you as, you know, they're the authority, and you know, you better take note of them, you know, and what they've experienced.
Yeah.
Then you know that makes a difference too. And of course, you know, I'm walking a very thin line too, because after, you know, I've had now over 40 years of unusual things happen to me, I feel that I've been able to connect a couple few dots here and there. And a lot of times it makes for easier to tell a story where I don't have to take an hour to patiently unpack an event, but I can just sort of cut to the chase with my conclusions, that sort of a thing. So I'm not dismissing somebody who has some sort of degree of certainty of what's happening to them, but when they hit you right off the bat with a narrative rather than the straightforward facts, I would say that's the time where you start saying, okay, maybe let's see who this person is behind the sighting, rather than, you know, just taking the basic notes down of what exactly it is that they saw.
Well, we're getting down to the last 9 minutes of the show. So I was going to say, we probably have time for one or two more questions. Did you have any questions you wanted to hit Bill with before I did?
Well, there's an account in Texas in the 1800s of a ship that crashed. Have you heard anything about that one, Bill?
That's
probably
the
Aurora Cemetery.
Did it
have
that?
They're buried in the. Is that the Aurora Cemetery or Aura Cemetery?
Mm-hmm, it is. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He hadn't heard of it. I already asked.
Well, there was. If
a reverend involved with that, so I just thought that was kind of cool.
Now I had visited Walt Andrus, a former international director of MUFON in Seguin, back in the late 90s, at what the time was MUFON's headquarters. It was in a strip mall, and I remember seeing a skeleton of some sort, and I believe, if I recall correctly, that Walt had associated it with some sort of crash in Texas, and I don't know if that's the same thing or not, but I remember seeing that when I was there. Again, this was like 20 years ago, so my memory of it is a little sketchy.
Yeah. Yeah, there's rumors about, you know, the crash and that the alien was buried and then it was moved, you know, to another location and under a tree in the cemetery. And there's a lot of just kind of random rumors out there with that particular situation.
Well, this one is not a rumor. This was around the this was another story. This was around the 40s or 30s. And this reverend in Missouri got called out. And this is documented, you know, in some papers and newspapers or whatever. But this reverend got called out, and there was three of these little aliens, and he was called out to do the last rites for these little gray men or green men. I'm not sure what they were to him. And there was a picture taken, and this picture is these two men holding up one of the bodies. And I saw the picture, of course, online. You can doctor a bunch of stuff online. But the story just intrigued me because, like I said, it was a reverend. And this has been passed down through his family for many years. There's also a picture of him. And he is talking to two military men. And, of course, they were telling him, you've got to keep this quiet, so on and so on. And so, you know, that it's just amazing to me is some of the things that are out there once I got to studying and doing some research on it about crashes and about people actually seeing these crashes, and there's accounts of them seeing the aliens that are with them and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there certainly is a lot of stories.
Yeah.
Bill, let me hit you with one more question. I think we can probably squeeze in. And then after that, I want to see where you're going to be at, if you've got any upcoming events before we go out. But I was going to ask you who your biggest inspiration is when it comes to ufology, or if you have anybody, and why.
The easiest answer that comes to mind are the people locally who have made a great impression on me. My good friend David Kaywood, who is also now passed, he was a great source of comfort in terms of what it's like to be, you know, a man who has grown up, you know, as an experiencer. He was wonderful in that respect. A gentleman, Dan Wright, who was a big founder, I think I would say as much as that, of our Michigan chapter. He was a great mentor. On the public scene, I enjoyed the company of Bud Hopkins a great deal, and I thought he was an outstanding person, and his shoes have proven impossible to fill in his absence, as hard as we all try collectively. And this is not a knock on the great work that everybody does in the abduction field, but that, you know, we're all standing on his shoulders, basically, you know, to be where we are right now.
And where can we find you? Are you at any events coming up? Like, I know you did Dundee, Michigan not that long ago. Any paracons or events coming up?
I have if anybody wants to friend me on Facebook, I do library talks quite regularly. Last night I spoke at a library in Warren, and it was well attended. I don't think there was quite 100 people there, though the last time I had spoken at that library, there was over 150. So Warren, Michigan loves their UFOs. Our Michigan MUFON meeting is this Sunday. Ohio State Director Tom Wertman will be talking about the infamous 1973 coin helicopter crash over Mansfield, Ohio. And there are some things in the hopper that I'll have to see if they pan out. There are a few dates that I absolutely can't do a UFO talk as much as I would love, and for some reason that's when people always want to have me come out, so we'll see what happens.
What about your website? Where can they find you? What's your website?
For MUFON, the international website is MUFON.com, MUFON.com. Our Michigan State website is MIMUFON.org. And I have a personal website. I haven't updated it in a little bit. It's experiencer.me, experiencer.me. And that's my personal site. It talks about some of my personal experiences. And any one of those websites is a way to get in contact with me, as well as, you know, like, so please hit me up on Facebook.
Awesome. Okay. So if you guys want to reach out to him, you know how to. I want to thank you, Bill, for coming on. Loved having you. I think we could talk to you probably for 2 or 3 hours, but unfortunately,
yeah,
the show's
going
to wrap. Yes. So thank you again, Star. I'll see you in a week, and we're going to go out with some music. Formerly Cold Steel Revolver, they do have a new name. I'll have to get that for you guys next week, and it's called Just Stay.
Count.